Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy? I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm his blood-sucking friend, Duncan Nicol.
And we're here to review Empire of the Damned by J. Christoph, the follow-up to last episode's book, Empire of the Vampire.
We are indeed, and this is a really exciting one. We loved the first book in the series, and we're very excited to find out quite how this sequel measures up. I think there's quite a bit of hype on this, Geordie.
Yeah, there has been, especially on my part. You know, I think it was about 2 years of difference in between when the books came out, and in that time, this has probably been one of the books I keep thinking, yeah, I'm really excited for when that book comes out. Like, I really want to find out what happens next. However, specifically, I was thinking, I really want to see how the story ends, because for some reason, I was convinced that this was the last book, but it's not. It's part two of a trilogy. There's still another one to come.
So, before we dive into this book, Geordie, why are we here? Who are we?
Well, Duncan, at Is This Just Fantasy, you and me, every other week, we get together, we read, review, and discuss a fantasy novel.
That's right, and if you want to know what the latest book we'll be talking about is, please head over and follow us on Instagram, where you'll find out when a new episode releases, and little extra tidbits along the way. Because we don't just read the book of the week. Well, actually, I sometimes just read the book of the week, but Geordie reads a lot. So, Geordie, have you read anything else in the last 2 weeks?
Yeah, actually, I've been dabbling around. I haven't finished anything, but I have been reading Elric and the Citadel of Forgotten Myths, the latest release by Michael Moorcock in the Saga of Elric. It's a surprise when you're like, yeah, you know, the series ended in 1966, but the latest book came out last year, so, and I've been making my way through. It's definitely in that era of Michael Moorcock's Elric where it's a little bit out there. The Stealer of Souls, this is not. It's much more in sync with, say, the Citadel. What was it called?
Fortress of the Pearl?
Yeah, much more in line with the Fortress of the Pearl and the Way of the Rose or whatever it's called. And the name of the Rose?
The Revenge of the White Rose.
No, the Revenge of the Rose. Oh my god, we're all over the place.
You're absolutely right.
Anyway, it's much more in line with that.
Elric is a great series.
It's weirder, and it's longer, and it's more drawn out. It's interesting, though. It really is. It feels like Michael Moorcock really wanted to like fill in some gaps with Elric. This takes place after the Flamebringers. It's all about Elric trying to get himself unhooked from Stormbringer. But it also just assumes you finish the series. Like, it literally spoils the end of Stormbringer by, like, characters who like, give him prophecies about what's going to happen next. I think I'm enjoying it well enough.
It's a fun series when, I think, like, I'm going to say 70% of all the books came out after the ending, and he just keeps going back and filling in.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, this adventure happened.
Thank God he never discusses his prior adventures when he's hanging out with Moonglum. Like, there's no point in Stormbringer where he stops and says, "Hey Moonglum, remember when you became like an elected official in your home country and you described me what a republic is and I was very confused? Ah well, let's go on and kill Philip Kaana or whatever." But yeah, slowly making my way through, enjoying it well enough, looking forward to see how it wraps up. Other than that though, my real interest for the week has been like a surprise hit. Duncan, I've recently been in a real Trekkie mood. Do you watch much Star Trek?
So the short answer is no. I grew up watching kind of reruns of Next Generation, and that's where I think my heart lies when it comes to Star Trek. And I remember watching the J.J. Abrams trilogy and having fun. But I'm quite like, I did watch the first season of, what's it called?
God.
Discovery?
Oh, Star Trek Discovery, yeah.
Is that the right one? Yeah, I remember watching the first season, and there was a moment in that where I was like, I'm enjoying it, and then something happens. It was like there was a moral quandary, and I just kind of noped out. I just went, no, I disagree. Like, the show's presenting something as morally right, and I ended up being like, I think you're really wrong. But let's just let it happen. And yeah, I fell off after the first season.
Sure, sure. So I've been rewatching some Deep Space Nine. And recently, knowing that it's going to come to an end soon, I was looking around and I realized, why aren't there any, like, Star Trek radio plays? Because it's full of great beep, 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 distinct sounds. And so much of the show could just be reliant on people describing what's happening, because they kind of do that anyway, even when there are like visual cues like spaceships and phasers. And so I looked around and I sent a message out to like a subreddit all about drama podcasts. And I said, are there any Star Trek with the numbers filed off series out there? And the immediate response I got back was, no, there aren't. But here is a metric ton of fan fiction, which people have done. And they've just made whole series of Star Trek as like as dramatic podcasts, where they've released them as like a radio play. And so I've been listening to Star Trek Outpost and absolutely loving it. It's like an amazing series of Star Trek just made by fans.
I mean, I've never known anyone to ever go, gosh, guys, is there like a... I want to explore this world more. Where the radio plays. That is such a unique thing for you, Geordie. And I'm glad to hear about it. I mean, I have seen I'm going to call it like the expanded universe. I know that's normally a Star Wars term of Star Trek. Like, it's quite big. There must be loads of books out there.
There are, but like... And they're not at my local bookstore. And they're not on Audible, so I don't really have a lot of easy ways of getting a hold of them. And I don't think, to my understanding, they are good.
Fair. I mean, people don't rave about them. That's the thing that I always find interesting. Like, the Star Wars fandom raves about the novels. Like, it goes, expands. But you're right, I've never had a Trekkie come up to me and be like, no, it only really hits it off in the books. So maybe that's why they're so hard to come by now. Yeah, but sometimes it does upset me. Like, in this modern age where anything could be digitized, when things aren't, I'm like, I just want effing on Kindle. And not that I want effing through Amazon, but it just upsets me the idea that I can't get hold of a book anymore.
Duncan, have you been reading anything else in the meantime?
I have not. That was quick.
Oh, yep, good. Well,
no, I really have enjoyed it. And it's mostly because this book we've just read, Empire of the Damned, it's a bit of a chonker. And although I did fly through it, I'd say this was one of the higher page counts we've ever tackled on the podcast.
That may well be true. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Knoll is definitely up there.
I feel like maybe Poppy War.
Definitely.
That was a long one. And Empire the Vampire.
I've got 646 pages of mine.
I have the same in mine. So it just beats out Murtagh, which was 550-odd, I think.
Yeah, I mean... pages don't mean shit in terms of how long a book is, but I'm not going to count the words.
No, and it certainly doesn't mean anything compared to how much of a slog it is to get through. Mm. A good author can make 600 pages go by faster than Geralt of Jory can get 8 pages through you.
That's true. And, Duncan, was this a slog to get through? What did you think about Empire of the Damned?
I really liked it. In a brief, I thought it was a breeze to read. Mm. I really enjoyed some of the new character perspectives we were given.
Mm, surprise.
I liked some of the ideas of challenging our original narrator, although I don't think they quite went as far as I was hoping they would. And overall, I thought this was a great next chapter. I kind of did feel the same way I think you alluded to at the start, where I was sort of hoping we'd get a bit further on in terms of the overarching narrative. Mm. But I do see that everything's been put in place to take us to Endgame.
Yeah, I'm very much of the same boat. I even have some of the same criticisms as you. I absolutely loved this book. I had such a blast reading it. There were plenty of times where I was just reading it during my lunch break and I was chuckling. But also, it was like super dramatic. I remember whilst I was reading the climax, my girlfriend and I were reading our books next to each other. And I was literally like gasping and like grabbing handfuls of my hair, being like... no! Oh, no! It was fantastic. It's been a really long time since I've been that tense and engaged with a book. So that was so rewarding.
So let's kind of lay the groundwork. Obviously, people, please go back and listen to our Empire the Vampire episode. But if you're not going to do that, this is the story of a world beset by vampires. Mm. An event called Day's Death has occurred, where the sun is now dimmed and the dead may walk in broad daylight. Mm. And what we're following is the story being recounted by the last of the great vampire hunters, Gabriel. He's the last of his order, and he's basically putting down his history of how, essentially, he messed up, and then he messed up some more, And now this is how he's gotten to the very end, where everyone's screwed and the vampires rule.
Exactly. He's being interviewed by a vampire, Teehee, and a history is being taken. And one of the things I really like about the book is that the first perspective character we get, previously, it's been... So the perspective in the book is interesting because most of the time, what we're reading is first person past tense, because it's literally Gabriel telling his autobiography. He's saying it out loud. However, the overall narration that describes Gabriel as he's telling his story and his conversations with Jean-Francois, the vampire, when he's not actually in storytelling mode, that's kind of omniscient. Like, it has access to everyone's heads. But right from the beginning of this book, it actually really hones in on Jean-Francois. And we get really honed in on him, and we see his, like, day-to-day... I was about to say life. His day-to-day existence, you know, being this evil master of human beings. Because up till now, he's so, you know, reserved and eloquent and gentlemanly that, you know, he wants to give the impression, oh, I'm not really that bad. But what this book does a great job of is that it demonstrates... He's not innately bad because he's a vampire. He still exists as a vampire because he's evil. He persists in a life of cruelty and, you know, leechdom because he doesn't mind exploiting the people around him. His servants, who he sleeps with, you know, he doesn't even know one of their names. He keeps getting it wrong.
It's sort of this kind of message of becoming a vampire doesn't make you evil.
Mm.
It's just you need to be evil to cut it as a vampire.
Exactly. And that's a take on vampires I really like. I remember having this debate with someone a couple of years back, being like, should vampires be necessarily evil? And or even like, is it wrong to kill vampires? Because, like, you know, they don't necessarily have to drink blood. If you just start killing vampires before you know their story, isn't that a bad thing to do? Which is this is a funny hypothetical to have, you know, to argue about the ethics of killing fictional beings. But my point has always been, a vampire, you know, requires blood to live, to continue existing. So either the vampire must do an evil deed and start killing people, or it has to choose to die. And if they just get destroyed by sunlight, any moral vampire would just walk into the sun. The only reason that some of these vampires are kicking around is that the sun doesn't kill them anymore.
Oh, it's a really tough one. I don't know if I quite come down in the same way. Because obviously there's so many caveats. You could say, well, a vampire doesn't have to drain someone dry to, you know, to get a bit of blood. And is it not comparable? You know, there are people in the world who need medication to keep going.
Yes, but the medication rarely comes... Like, it's like a baby. A baby requires milk to live. But the mother isn't, like, isn't in a deep, true way harmed by that experience. Vampires are a dark inversion of that. Instead of life being given through love, it's life being taken by force. You know, and in some ways, the human being is being made into a tool. They aren't even a person anymore. They are a source of sustenance. They are being made less than what they are.
And the only way that the vampires kind of steps beyond that is to go to the next level and go, well, you humans eat meat, you go and kill your animals, I am just a fact of nature. Is a wolf evil for killing a sheep?
I think this conversation does happen in the book, because they say, oh, your kind hunted us first, but only one side, like, requires people to eat, and the other side doesn't. So the fun thing is,
I think
these are ideas that a book plays with. I think we have gone a little heavy on them right from the get-go, but a lot of the horror in the book comes from the dehumanization of people. It comes to people being treated like farm animals. You know, we see people being penned or lined up or bartered on. And so it plays with imagery that surrounds, you know, chattel and also slavery as well, you know, all of that combined together. That's the real source of evil. That's why the vampires are bad and have to be stopped.
So shall we actually kind of step back from that, the wider ideas? And they are interesting ideas. I do think they're explored quite nicely here, particularly when it comes to maybe vampires have been a bit defanged in more wider literature. You know, Twilight was very influential. It's nice to see a real kind of hard side to them again. Something that wouldn't be out of place to some of the vampiric monsters in sort of D&D. But this is also a story of characters, and we've already mentioned the main one, Gabriel. I say the main one. And the second main one, Dior, who is Gabriel's surrogate daughter and also the Holy Grail, the saviour of the land, or so legend says.
Exactly. I really like Gabriel and Dior in this book in particular. I think their relationship has just... I think it was pretty good in a previous book, but it really just revs up, and it's so enjoyable to see them interact. It's so touching to see how much they care about each other and how much they believe in each other. It's fantastic. Whether they're together or whether they are yearning for each other's company, I think it's really solid stuff.
It's, for me, it was so kind of heartfelt and touching to see these two characters, this older male figure who's lost his daughter, and he's in it, and when he first kind of latches onto Dior, I'm like, oh god, I hope that like this doesn't become uncomfortable or a point of where, you know, she'll turn around and be like, you know, you're not my father, stop telling me what to do. But I kind of like the fact that they do kind of meet in the middle. She's looking for someone to be more of a paternal figure, something that she's been missing pretty much her whole life. And I like the fact that when they do kind of connect, and she calls him like Papa at one point, and I'm like, oh, heart melts. It's a really lovely scene.
Exactly. It's a great setup reminder moment, because the first time she says that, it's like in a really sarcastic, sardonic teenage way, like, do as you're told. It's like, yes, Papa. And then there's this quiet moment afterwards because they accidentally stumbled into this moment of sensitivity. But then at the closure of the book, when they're reunited after this long gap, she earnestly and wholeheartedly calls him Papa. And that's really touching because it goes to show that how much they've missed each other and how much they've wanted each other's company.
And that's been really nice. And I also like the fact that it never gets too, I'm going to say, overbearing. Because I do think there's a lot to unpack with the fact that Gabriel, you know, he's not that long lost his sort of blood family and his original daughter. And I think it's nice that that doesn't too much complicate it. You know, he's there to be a parental figure, and there's still some nice moments where Gabriel doesn't really know how to be a good parental figure, given the intensity of the situation. So I like that kind of side of it. That's not the only relationship Gabriel has in this book, Geordie. He also picks up another one.
I think that's right. So we only floated this very gently in a previous episode, but it becomes an absolutely important staple in this book. When Gabriel was a boy and he was just starting out as a vampire hunter, his hometown was destroyed by a vengeful vampire who he'd run into. And his whole family, his mother, his adopted father, and his sister were all killed. However, at the closure of the book, Gabriel discovers that this vampire, this mysterious, powerful vampire he's fought several times in his ventures alongside Dior, is actually his sister. Dun dun dun. And that she has been following him and Dior because she believes in Dior as the Grail, and she wants to take Dior, and to that she wants to end Dave's death, just and she, like him, wants to end Dave's death with Dior. But she doesn't want him to be a part of it because she fucking hates him.
I'm going to come and say it. I felt she was being a bit unfair throughout this whole book.
She has had a bit of a hard knock, but Celeste?
I thought it was Celine, so clearly I'm off.
I don't think it's Celine.
I'm going to skim through the book.
Celine. My mistake.
Oh, it's good to be right.
All right. What was I saying before I was humiliated?
You're saying she had a hard knock in life.
She, yeah, so first of all, She was tortured to death. And, you know, that's a bad start. That's a really bad start. But also, like, it's really interesting that... So, Celine becomes a perspective character. A big twist in this story. When I was reading this, I was surprised to see that it wasn't jumping back and forth in time anymore. I thought that was a motif that was going to be kept up. But as time went on, it sort of tricks you. Because when it moves between book one and book two, Gabriel's still talking, and he's still talking about his adventures in, well, not the present, but in the, like, most immediate past with Dior. And I'm like, oh, so we're just doing away with that. We're not jumping through time anymore. And to be honest, I was a little bit disappointed by that, because I really wanted to see his, like, crusades and find out how he found Ashdrinker and, like, hear about his other adventures. And that happens a little bit, but it's really quickly moved over. It's not the focus at all.
It certainly changes the dynamic of the book. I just want to kind of get back on that, because the first book is split between this more traditional quest and a bit of a special school story. You know, he's going to vampire
it's an origin
school.
Story and the, like, more standard lone wolf and cub Mandalorian season 2 story.
And to have that completely cut from the second book, one, I do think it's actually great because it's progression. I do feel like I was done with school. You know, we graduated. But you're quite right. I was expecting us to maybe still have that time dynamic, because we still get a lot of talk about between the end of special school and the start of the, I'm going to call it the Grail plotline. It's like he was on crusades and they were winning battles. And when you read a lot of the current plotline, in the Grail plotline, where it's kind of defeat after defeat, I wouldn't mind having moments of just like, can we just flash to him winning for a tiny bit? But instead of that, we get
Celine, it turns out, is also a captive of the Chastain vampires, and Jean-Francois at a certain point reveals this, and Gabriel is furious when he discovers that his sister is still alive, and he says, you can't trust a word she says, she's a liar, she's a snake. And when he goes to speak to Celine, she's like, you've been talking to my brother? You can't trust a thing he says. He's a liar. He's a snake.
Fantastic. I loved it when this was revealed. I loved the fact of the reveal where the historian's like, Gabriel's at one point, he's like, oh, I lost track. I don't know what happened for the next bit. And he's like, don't worry. I have someone who does. Now, this was good, but I mentioned this earlier, Jordi. I want to get your take on this. When they both accuse each other of that, I'm like, oh my god, we're going to get a real hard cut. Like, the story Gable's told us so far, like, particularly in the first book, when they were fighting, and, like, he was trying to save Dior, is it going to be real that, like, we had the wrong perspective on that? And they don't. They basically do always agree on what actually happened.
Basically, there's, like, one moment way later in the book when they were recounting a battle, and they say, no, it wasn't, I don't know, Dylan who went there. It was Billy. Billy led the charge there. And they argue about that for a bit. And that's really all that happens in terms of direct disagreement. The one big difference, and this was really great, was they have very different perspectives on their parents.
Yes. In the first book, Gabriel was very clear that he had a wonderful, loving mother, and it's that pesky stepdad. Oh, the bastard. Always giving him the belt.
And Celine says, Mum was raised to be a noblewoman, and she was now a blacksmith's wife, and she never really adjusted to that, and she was difficult, and she was bossy, and she never treated her daughter well, and she always wanted more, and she made Gabriel into this egotistical, pompous prick. Which he kind of is. She's right on the money there. And she sees her father as this hard-working... Yeah, did he have a drinking problem? Sure, but he was a kind man and very patient otherwise. And that was a great... That's a very relatable experience between siblings to have different perspectives on, you know, a parent and their behavior and how they treat you or one sibling kind of differently. And also, it was really interesting because when I read Empire of Vampire again, I had read this section and I had seen how Celine had done things on a saw things differently. And it actually took me back to the first book and to this one particular part where they're swapping tales around a campfire and Gabriel says, one time, my stepdad's drinking problem was so bad that my mother hid all his clothes so he couldn't go out to the pub. But instead, he found her, like, fanciest dress, and he put that on, and he walked to the pub anyway, like, without a care in the world. And Gabriel's perspective there is, look at this guy. He was such a fucking drunk that he would dress himself up as a woman in order to drink. But if you ask Celine about that, she'd be like, well, yeah, my father was proud and he wasn't going to be bossed around. And so he stepped up and he dressed in ladies' clothes because he didn't care. He didn't care what people thought of him.
It's such a nice moment. And I just wish I had more of it. I'm like, could you...
Now, here's the thing, Duncan.
Yep.
I think there is a lot more lying taking place. And we're going to have to talk about this when we get to the end of the book and the climax and all of that. But I think the reason why each of them is like, you can't trust that person. They're a liar. You can't trust a damn thing they say. It's because they know they're kept in separate cells. You know, prisoner dilemma style. They know their stories aren't going to line up. So they have to say, you can't trust a thing that person says, because they don't want discrepancies between their stories to be picked up on.
Oh, that is a good theory. And it does line up with, because near the end of this book, you definitely get the impression that a lot of their back and forth is definitely for show. Not 100%, but I think they're egging it up a bit.
Yeah, they definitely fucking hate each other.
So, do you know what, Jordy? We just had this great chat about Celine. She wasn't the one I was actually referencing.
Okay.
I actually meant the other woman in Gabriel's life who gets introduced in this book.
Phoebe?
Phoebe.
Yes. That's probably the biggest twist in this whole quite twisty story.
Yes, Phoebe is a... changeling werecat
dusk dancer.
That's the name he gives them in this.
Yeah.
Yes,
classic. Who... Phoebe, a character who we've all come to know and love over the course of a series. What's that? You don't think she was in the first book? No, she was, because Phoebe was Saoirse's mountain lion cat friend. She was in the whole book, but she was just in animal form the whole time. Duncan, do you think he just made this up?
Yes, he did.
He was just like, I need another character. Phoebe's back, and she was a lady the whole time.
Definitely. There is no way, given the level of intimate romance which is described in this book, he would have left that cat just as a cat in the first one. It just doesn't seem right to me.
I'm a bit torn. Because it's so huge. It's such a huge change that I'm like, he can't just have made this up. He wouldn't have the balls to do that. To say Gabriel's new girlfriend was in the previous book. I promise, she just was a cat the whole time. Now, there is only one moment of credence to this, which is that when he in the previous book, there is a moment where Saoirse, like, basically gives, like, a complicated command to Phoebe, and Phoebe growls, like she can understand her and respond to her. But that could really easily just be attributed to Saoirse's, like, vague druidy magic, as opposed to, you know, they have, like, it's classic. She has a connection to her ranger companion animal, you know?
There is no characterization on that lion that make you think it was a person. And not only that, but even the concept of the dusk dancers... lightly touched upon. In fact, there is no reason in that party, in that first book, why Phoebe being a skin changer would be kept secret.
No, that's not true at all. They absolutely would keep that secret. Like, not even Dior's gender was known to everyone in the party. And, like, Père Rafa would not have been okay with travelling around with a changeling. I mean, a dusk dancer.
I'm gonna say yes, but you... Okay, put it this way, though. Gabriel, as he's recounting that bit of the story, knows it's Phoebe.
Yeah, but he does dramatic irony all the time, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does like that.
It's really funny how, like, it's great that, you know, Celine and Gabriel do talk slightly differently. but they have the exact same, like, dramatic style, because obviously that's how J. Christoph likes to write. He likes to hold back information and then dramatically reveal it later. But it means that Jean-Francois has to say, man, I'm always dealing with you two siblings, and you both keep jerking me around by holding back information and only dramatically revealing it later.
I get the impression that when Gabriel's giving his sort of speech, he's almost dancing about the room, and he's like, and then, arms out wide, as he came into the clearing and like moves his arm in transformation. I just feel like these moments, particularly when he's like grabbing his sword, I just see him like jumping up on the table, be like, and then I did this, and then I did that, like shadow fencing.
That's true. That's pretty good. I like that. I don't think that's the impression we're supposed to have, but it is pretty funny to imagine.
So I'll let that stand.
Probably,
yes, Phoebe.
Phoebe, this was a retcon. Probably this was a retcon. But what do you think of the character of Phoebe?
Really mixed. I really liked some bits. Personally, I liked her introduction, because I think we needed another character to work off Gabriel.
That absolutely.
Very important. I liked her culture. The Change,
yep,
Dust Dancers and the world they come from. And I liked the way we've gone a different twist on vampires in this book series, Geordie. And I like having a little different twist on werewolves, effectively. Mm-hmm. That's what they're here to provide. I like the idea that what happens, you can change sort of at will, but you can only change back at certain times. And every time you do it, you are going to get a little bit more animalized every time
That's
you change
right.
back. And it gets to the point where there are some blokes in her society who literally just forever walk around with a full lion's mane and like snout.
This was set up in the previous book, like it's mentioned literally once, like this Dusk Dancer, like he had a tail because he transformed so many times. But it goes whole hog and you see its impact, and like these are like, they're from fantasy French Scotland. So they all have, you know, names that start with Muck, and they're from like Dun whatever. But it is actually like, it is really interesting, because he plays with this fascinating idea where, I shouldn't just call them the Scots. I'm going to get the map out.
Highlanders.
They're not just Highlanders. Well, actually, there is a diff. They do make a distinction between Highlanders and Lowlanders, which is very appropriate for your fantasy version of Scotland. That's an important part of our identity, is disliking each other. I'm talking about Osway. That's the word for it. Osway.
You're going to have to explain that word to me.
Osway? It's fantasy Scotland.
Oh, is that what they call it in this book? I just called it the
it's
Highlands.
A country. Well, they're from the Highlands, but the country is called Osway.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. You're right. It's nice that they have a bit of flavour of different culture and different places we're moving through. I never really got a big sense. Do you know what I didn't get a great sense of, Geordie? Is how big some of these countries are and how long it was taking to move between them. That issue
it,
you had?
It did feel a bit. It did feel a bit weird, because at one point they say, like, basically they've been travelling for months. And I did some mental maths whilst I was reading Empire to Vampire, and that basically checks out, because they do travel around so much. I think J. Christoph, if he does Dungeon Master, and he probably does, I get this feeling that he does, he's definitely the guy who doesn't bother about tracking ammunition and food and stuff, because them traveling around in the dead of winter for literal months, and you never worry, have them worry about running out of food.
No, not even brought up. Even though things like prey creatures are now super rare.
Yeah.
No, so like wolves are super rare, and birds are getting rarer, and like you're barely scraping survival. It's like, are you just foraging? Are you just carrying some beef jerky in your backpack?
There's just a lot of mushrooms around, man. I don't know what to tell you.
I mean, that might explain a few things about Gabriel. But, yeah. Anyway, sorry, back to Phoebe, which is what I want to talk
yes.
about. So I really like the world and the culture that she comes from. What I wasn't so sure about is how quickly she comes in as this sort of romantic interest for Gabriel, given the trauma that he's sort of recently gone through with the loss of his wife, and the role his wife played in the first book. And particularly, and firstly, I know this is the plot point, that Gabriel is like, oh, can I open up? Can I love again? Do I want to be with someone? But when I compare this romance to the romance that he had with, oh my goodness, I've forgotten her name.
Astrid.
Astrid, thank you. And like seeing them grow up in special school together and knowing that they eventually fall in love and he has to abandon the order and all of that. I just don't know how I kind of felt about it. It's like, Gabriel's ready? Am I ready? Who are you again? Where have you come from into our plot?
It kind of feels like, Duncan, you're kind of aggrieved about, like, a new stepmom moving in.
Well, that was what was hard, because ultimately I was rooting for Gabriel to, say, like, get with Phoebe. I mean, to move on and, like, have that healing process.
Get over it! Your dead wife turned into a vampire and you had to kill her?
Oh, and you're so traumatized when Phoebe first visits you one night for a very explicit scene. You're half asleep and you still think it's your vampiric dead wife back to have sex with you. Remember that, Geordie?
I do remember that.
Didn't do it for me. I don't know what to say. I was reading those scenes thinking,
pretty hot.
I kind of want this to end.
It's going to be, listen, it's better than the sex scenes in the first book. I don't know what to tell you.
I do prefer these two, you know, scarred individuals coming together rather than people who I kept thinking, are you of age? That was, you know, that was more uncomfortable. You're right.
They're all the same age. Don't worry about it. Listen, I like the fact, so I haven't really said much about Phoebe so far. And I think I definitely come out of it being like, yeah, I like Phoebe. She was really essential for the story to work because Gabriel gets separated. That's an important plot point. He needs to have someone to talk to. And I like the fact that essentially Phoebe is all about making him see in more shades of grey. You know, he's already this really jaded person, but the linchpin of his success in this book is relying on things that he would previously have thought of as monsters. You know, as much as he is, like, in Empire of the Vampire, a really dark, bitter person, and, like, he resents everything around him, like, the church and the vampires both, he's still in a really stark mindset where he just is so antisocial and so cruel and so bitter. This book requires him to, like, charm people, to be convincing. Like, he has to get his own way. And it's for that reason, and this is because of the influence of Phoebe, I like Gabriel in this book so much more than a previous one. And in fact, I like this book a lot more than a previous one.
I do not know. Where do I take that statement? You like this book more?
I do. I'm the one who read it most recently.
That is true. I haven't reread the first book now for nearly 2 years. I think, ultimately, I do think this was a better written book, particularly scene for scene. I think that is true. I think the only thing that this book kind of focuses on is that obviously it doesn't have the initial impact of the opening. You know, I know this world. I'm sort of familiar with what I'm getting. But as a climax, I think this had more punch the air moments. It certainly avoids the big, like, the ending of the first book. I don't particularly like Geordie. We really kind of felt like I teared into it when we discussed it.
Yeah, that's true. Because
I don't have that problem as much with this one.
No.
So
the last book,
we
didn't like the ending as much of the last one because the fight with Danton, having read it quite recently, didn't cover this in the Empire of Vampire episode, but it's actually quite brief. It doesn't take that long. It's over in, like, it's one chapter and then it's done. Danton's dead. And then they go to Saint-Michel and then he has to kill his old comrades in arms. And we didn't like it as much because it's basically a ripoff of The Last of Us. This book is not a ripoff of The Last of Us. In fact, it rips off just a lot less stuff. This book, you know, the pieces are in play. You've got, like, the same lone wolf and cub relationship, but it feels much more established. It feels much more like it has its own identity. This book has more of its own ideas, and those ideas which it borrowed before, well, now they're just part of Empire of the Vampire. And the story just keeps going. And it feels much more like its own thing. And I think that's so much better than the previous book, where it felt like a lot of stuff which J. Christoph liked in other books and movies and video games.
With a nice wrapper around it, but still you could see
it's
those
still,
elements.
It's still a good book.
This book had some moments, really. Like, when we first talked about Empire of the Vampire, so what can I remember? Like, I remember vodka being cheaper than whiskey because you can grow potatoes in less light. This book, I'm like, what am I going to remember? How about the scene where Gabriel, after, even though everything I've just said, after a very descriptive sex scene with Phoebe, he drinks a bit of her blood. Someone comes in the room, punches him through a window. He falls into a great hall and then butt naked has a fist fight with all these like changeling people.
Yeah.
Fucking amazing. Like, this
is so good.
So dumb.
This book is so badass. It's the climax in especially, like, it's long. It's like jump back and forth between different locations. Everyone's fighting. It's this crazy battle across a cityscape. There are numerous showdowns of ancient vampires from like a whole bunch of different fronts. And it's so good.
Even from like early on in the book, some of these action set pieces are great. There's a great scene where him and his sister are like holding a bridge. And
that's true. I love people holding bridges.
I love it. And I love the fact that they like, set fire to the thing of the bridge and they're like, right, that'll give us some time. And then the vampiric thralls, they like crawl along the underside of the bridge and like jump up at them from the sides.
I love
that too.
I love it when people crawl along the underside of things. It's so true. The action in this book is on point because I think, like I said before, the pieces are in play. He has all of their tools, you know, set up already so he can just let them do cool shit. He doesn't have to explain it now.
It kind of gave me a little bit of that, I'm going to say almost like, it's the word shonen vibe. So that anime kind of fight scene sometimes where in one smaller battle, power levels will be, and a bit lower, a bit more closer to like what you think of like a real human being. And then eventually people will be just thrown through like six blocks of buildings and then just get back up with a bruise.
That literally happens at one point. Literally, Gabriel does get thrown through multiple buildings at one point.
So that is fun. And like when that's that throwdown and we're going to that hyper level of action, if you can buy into it and you can accept the fact that we have left... Yeah. Any semblance that Gabriel is a normal human being, and he never is, but really leave that behind, it's a delight.
It is. That like, one of the main bad guys has a literal berserk sword. Nikita has a sword called Epitaph, which is a great name for a sword, and it's like 7 feet tall. And he swings around because he has superhuman strength. But J. Christopher's like, and these vampires, the Blood Divok, they're so superhumanly strong they can use these big weapons, but they have a special fighting style where like they allow the momentum of their attacks to carry them through the air so they can do the crazy berserk fighting.
Oh, that scene, it almost kind of invokes like the mighty Thor. Like he's throwing his sword about like it's Mjolnir and it's just carrying him with it.
That's literally, it literally is a bit where like he has to be like, I have to leave now, I'm overwhelmed. And like Thor, he like spins it around, basically, he doesn't literally spin it, but he swings his sword up and the momentum makes him fly into the air.
And I don't know, what is the physics? If you're that light and have such a like weight to power ratio, I guess that is what happens.
Yeah, because like he has the tensile strength to survive the impact. It's basically like a sling. You know, he's throwing it and he just happens to get dragged along. So we talked a little bit about how the story is, you know, awesome. But I think we should hone in the big plot change which happens. And that is that at around a third of the way in, Dior is abducted and she's separated from Gabriel.
Yes, and this is where we get that first shift in perspective, where we first go to Celine. Because Celine stays with Dior as a little bloody moth. Oh, Celine's the blood mage. That wasn't mentioned earlier. So we're following Celine's perspective on Dior as she gets captured by the vampires.
And that means that the perspective we have on Dior is a bit different, because instead of being in Gabriel's head and having recount how he felt, now we are relying on Celine to interpret how Dior feels. And the interesting feeling about it is the way in which you can say to yourself, can I trust Celine? Not as a liar, but as someone who is capable of understanding Dior. She has the full context for what's happening. And most of the time she's just saying, she looks like this. She looks sad. She looked weary. But there's also bits where, and this is a great example of it, she constantly refers to her as the Grail. She doesn't really think of her as a little girl, like a 16-year-old. She thinks of her as this savior figure, She thinks of her as this divine force. And she refuses, and therefore, you know, she interprets the times when she sort of denies her destiny by trying to focus on the peons. She gets frustrated with that. And she, like, instead of explaining why Dior is doing it, we're not permitted that insight. Instead, we just see the ways in which Celine is a little frustrated or a little scared on Dior's behalf.
And it goes further where we have scenes where Celine doesn't have eyes on Dior. And so we don't know every kind of move that happens to her.
There's this great moment where Dior and some of her allies, they find this hidden place. This place that Celine has been searching for. She's been looking for this buried ancient vampire. And it's on holy ground, which means Celine can't go in. Nor can she ask Dior questions while she's a moth. So all we see is they vanish, they wait, and they come back, and like their shoes are wet, and all of them have, they are white-faced and have shaken expressions, and we have no idea what they've seen. It's not described to us until much later.
So Geordie, what's actually happening to Dior in this bit of the book? Because she gets captured, she's separated from Gabriel, she's got to go alone, or effectively alone. What does this do for Dior? Like, does she really, is this a moment of growth? Is this about her reuniting? Is this her becoming the Grail? Like, what is her arc for this?
So that's really interesting. To begin with, when I started reading this section, I was a little frustrated because we'd been with Gabriel for such a long time and it's his perspective we're used to. And I kind of was hoping that Dior's section would be a bit shorter and then we could get back to Gabriel and they could be reunited and blah, 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 blah. But actually, as time went on, I really liked Dior's chapters. I really liked them a lot because there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening. Dior's arc, like you said, to put bluntly, is about becoming a leader. It's about her maturing as and taking on the responsibility which has been thrust upon her by divine lineage. She is almost by the divine right of kings. She has special blood. She's in charge. And she's not prepared for that. She cares too much about saving individual people as opposed to looking at the big plan. That's a huge argument she has with Gabriel early in the book. But it's the classic, oh, I don't want to put anyone else except myself in danger. It's that classic heroic motif. It's what makes Dior someone you want to follow because the reason she struggles with taking on responsibility is not really out of fear. It's out of a fear of leading other people to their death. It's out of compassion.
And it's really kind of challenging because it kind of hangs in the balance of Dior's own innocence and what little innocence she kind of has left, because you're kind of like, well, I want you to grow and I want you to be able to take on the mantle and be a strong leader. And at the same time, I'm like, yeah, but I don't want you to lose like what makes you and you a good person surrounded by all this evil. Yeah, at the same time, in this whole scenario, you're like, but
yes,
only by being evil can she beat the greater evil. And what am I rooting for here again?
Exactly. Exactly. It's conflicting. You're not really sure how to feel as a reader. And that's a good sign about the, you know, about the push and pull of a narrative, about how it sort of strings you along and you're like, oh, I'm not sure what to feel. What really works in those chapters as well is the sense of peril, like a serious, serious sense of peril. In some ways, she's more bulletproof than Gabriel because the vampires don't want to eat her. If they eat her, they'll die. Her blood sets vampires on fire. So in some ways, she's safer than Gabriel is, because vampires, when they run into him, they try and kill him. But this isn't like her power fantasy novel. Gabriel can fight tons of people. He takes down other silver saints. He fights vampires. He has a fist fight with numerous dusk dancers and gets thrown through buildings and gets up fine. But Dior can't do any of that. She's in so much more danger just from the fact that she's essentially a normal person. Her blood can heal other people with magic, but she can't heal herself. So when she's abducted and when she's taken to, is it Mergain? What's the name of the city?
Oh, you know, I'm not giving pronunciations. Mergir.
I think it's Mergain. Mergain. You gotta just say it like a Scot. When she's taken to Mergain, she's basically inducted into a vampiric court. Nikita, the one vampire leader, and what's the heartless one called? Lilith? Yeah, it's spelled weirdly, but it's, I think, pretty sure
anything, it has a random
Lilith.
D in it. It's like Lilith.
And, yes, except that it's one of those D's which is like, which I think is a TH sound. I'm pretty confident that it's pronounced Lilith. I haven't listened to the audiobook this time, so I can't say for certain, but I'm pretty sure it's Lilith.
Anyway, we get to see the sort of the horrors of this vampiric court, and this is great to really show how horrific the vampires are in terms of being uncaring and just brutal, I suppose the term, and dehumanizing.
Yeah, super violent, like clockwork orange violent.
I'll be honest with you, it's kind of interesting because this disturbs me a lot more than when we see it in action scenes. I'm not 100% sure what it is, but like in a sword fight or when Gabriel's flying across the battlefield, I can take that lots of people are getting beheaded in moments. That's fine. What I can't stand is hearing from the maid who had to go in and clean up after the vampiric, I'm going to call it orgy. You could call it a banquet. It was a bit of both for them.
Technically speaking, orgy just means banquet. Oh. So that is a correct
term. Not so much. Exactly. And like that is so much more real. It kind of brings it down to this harsh ground level.
And there's a reason for that. It's because the violence in Gabriel's chapter exists for the sake of excitement, titillation, but most of all to empower Gabriel and therefore us as the reader. You know, like the suffering he goes through, it only enhances to make us think like, oh yeah, that means Gabriel's tough enough to get through this and get out the other side. And therefore I, the reader, vicariously am experiencing this at the same time. Whereas Dior, the peril and danger and bloodshed surrounding her is designed to enhance the sense of helplessness. It's the opposite of a power fantasy.
For me, it was these really tiny moments with Dior when she's having a bath and then it's like wearing high heels. And when she's having a bath and she's getting like scrubbed down, it's like, this is uncomfortable. And it's like, oh, okay, we're bringing it right back from the superhero now. Now I'm in that bit where I'm feeling the sensation of just having like a rough cone. That is what makes you uncomfortable. And then you're surrounded by these killer machines.
And the threat of violence on every side, and both in terms of being like physically attacked and sexually. Like in that very scene, Nikita, the evil vampire warlord, shows up without permission and gets in a bath with her. And she can't do shit. There's this super immense sense of
like,
sexual
intentionally,
violence,
obviously, so
just hanging on the edge.
Unlike maybe some of the Phoebe scenes that I've done in the bath.
And that's, you can say it's off, but I actually think it is handled quite well because we don't see, like, it's not out there in the open just happening for shock value. The threat of it is present, but it's not, in my opinion, overdone. And it's not done in order to make, like, her rescue seem more important. It's not like, say, well, it's certainly not like the Poppy War, where it's out there and it's disgusting and it's repellent. And it's not like, say, Twilight, where it goes to show it's put into the book because it needs to make Edward seem heroic. It happens. The sense of peril is in the air, but then it doesn't happen. Like, Nikita doesn't rape Dior. He just uses it to intimidate her. And then the story goes along, and that's just something that Dior has hanging over her.
I think you're quite right. And I think, actually, by only having that one scene, it sort of puts it on the table, so you get, as a reader, have this impression. And I'll be honest, from the rest of the book, I went, oh, is Jay Kristoff going to go there? I wouldn't be surprised.
Exactly.
As an author.
Exactly. That's the purpose of, you put the gun on the table, is it going to go off?
And I think he did a really good job there, like letting me think.
The reason
that
why
he
the
might.
Gun doesn't go off is that someone else is Nikita's victim. And that, this part of the book was so gutting to me, and it made me gnaw my nails down to their roots.
Oh no, Geordie, I'll be honest here, I almost don't want to talk about this bit.
It's so fucking sad.
It works. Oh, I'm glad it's kept as vague as it is. I think that was a very wise decision on the part of Jay Kristoff, and I'm very thankful he did that. And I think he did a great job of making me feel the emotional punch without outright disgust. Please describe what happened.
Without specifically talking about, like the sexual assault of Aaron, I want to talk more broadly about Aaron and Baptiste in this book. Because they are such a warm, pleasant presence at the end of Empire to Vampire, where you have these two characters who kind of have shit sorted. You know, they've been kicked out of a Silver Order, but they have each other, they're in love, they have a cool castle, which is pretty much impregnable. They represent this safe haven, this place that Gabriel could go to be safe if he wanted to. His decision to press on and go on adventures beyond their help is a moment of heroism for him. By taking them off the table, this not only is it sad to see bad things happen to Baptiste and Aaron, but it also takes away that sense of safety, that sense that anything could go back to normal. And fucking Aaron and Baptiste go through such a ringer in this book.
I am genuinely surprised that they're both, I was about to say alive, that they're both still existing at the end of this novel. There were so many That's moments right. that I thought one of these two characters was going to be offed.
Yeah, yeah. The funny thing is, Gabriel is constantly referred to as the last Silver Saint. Baptiste was never a Silver Saint. Aaron was cast out of the Order before he was made a knight. And even his tattoos are removed in this book. And he's a vampire. He's not a Silver Saint. That means that those two could still be alive by the end of a trilogy. No promise would be broken there. He would still be the last Silver Saint.
Oh, we've got to get to another bloke in a second then, because he ain't making it.
Yep, he's gone. He's fucking gone.
But yes, absolutely right. Aaron and Baptiste. These are two lovers in the story who get separated, and what we really see through their perspective, seeing that they're not as special as Dior, we really see the impact of the vampire's power to create thralls through them. So this is when a vampire forces you to drink your own blood, drink their own blood. Classic Dracula. Proper Dracula moment with him making Mina Lucy drink his blood. And if they do it three times in a row, I think on three separate days, I'm not going to lie, I was a bit like, okay, very specific, but all right.
Yeah, it has to be on different days. But it's any time. Like, it could be years later you drink that third drop and it would still count.
You will be enter this sort of intensive adoration of the vampire. You will do anything to please them. And there's some great moments here about...
And this is executed...
beautifully. I mean, really harshly. It's all about the forced love. And it's something that we can then look back at the early chapters with our glorious historian and go, oh... all of your repertoire, they must all be in the same boat. You know, that's why they mm-hmm. adore you, and that's how you're ruling.
What's wonderful about it is that it makes this, it draws this line between the heroes who are fighting out of love for their fellow man. Baptiste, at the end, is fighting for Aaron's sake in a really gut-clenching scene of watching him struggle to try and get through to Aaron. The classic, I know you're still in there somewhere kind of fight. Which should be cheesy, but it just isn't. It's so sincere. And everything about the vampires, you know, like the Divok have a power called the Whip, where they can make people do stuff by like forcing their will sharply upon them. So it's all about compelled love versus genuine true love. And isn't that such a sappy thing for something in this edgy, dark, gothic book to be hung up on? The idea of true love winning in the end. Isn't that so sweet?
I mean, it is. But I think this book does a great job of balancing its tone so that you can kind of accept it. I'll be honest, I didn't think while reading it I'd bring up anime so much. But it's a bit of the power of friendship.
There's a lot of anime here.
You'll get, you know, if we can just be true to each other and it's the friends we made on the journey, they're our strength. That kind of get that idea across. And the fact that the vampires are always going to be inherently selfish and looking after number one. When they have, there's a great description here where they say, when eternity's on the cards, you wouldn't believe the lengths they'll go to keep it there. Whereas a human that knows they're only ever gambling 20 years,
Absolutely. Well,
they'll happily throw it all away. They've got less to lose.
Yeah, they live for other people. You know, they can live for something more, and vampires can't, because all they can do is live forever. They have the chance to live forever. You'd do anything to keep that. The other thing, which the taking of blood and enthrallment, the thing that adds to this book, is that it's a great ticking clock. You don't know in Dior's chapters how far away Gabriel is. You don't know whether he's right over the horizon. So what you think must happen is Gabriel has to show up on the last day, right before she can drink his blood. She can drink Lilith's blood and become her thrall. And this is just handled really well, because the fact we don't have access to Dior's head means that we only see Celine's dread as day by day she drinks more and more of Lilith's blood and she seems to fall more and more under her thrall. And on that third day, Gabriel doesn't show up. He doesn't show up. He's days behind schedule.
And this gets us one of our best uses of Celine not being in Dior's head. Because then we get one of my favourite kind of reveal moments. We said Jacobsoff, he loves a information reveal. And we then get the reveal that Dior's blood makes her immune to the thralling power. And not only is she immune, that she can release other thralls using her blood.
What a fucking great twist. I wanted it to be true. Like, at to begin with, I was like, oh, maybe she's immune to it. Like, she's immune to the hypnosis and their other stuff. Maybe she can tough through. But because you're seeing it through Celine's eyes and Dior is acting, she's pretending that she's falling more and more under Lilith's spell. When it's all said and done, I genuinely believe that she was completely under her power after that third day. And when it was revealed that she wasn't, I was like, oh my god! Yes, J. Christoph, you're a genius!
I very genuinely thought at this point that we were going to get a scene. When I thought Dior was under Lilith's power, I thought we were going to get a scene like we got between Baptiste and Aaron. I thought it was going to be Gabriel, like, forced somehow to fight Dior and being like, stop, I'm not going to hurt you.
That's not a fair fight.
I don't think that would actually happen. You'd just have to tuss her up and be like, okay,
no,
you lie down here. I'm going to go kill the vampire. So yeah, that was a great scene.
Yeah, and one more thing that's great about this motif and the way it creates stakes. Ha ha, vampires. Is that the only other way to break it, aside from feeding someone Dior's blood, which breaks the spell, is to kill the vampire who did it in the first place. Hey, classic Dracula, right? That means that when Baptiste and Aaron are under Nikita's spell, you say, well, that means that not only will Gabriel maybe have to fight Aaron, his brother in arms, he has no choice. He would much rather not fight an insanely powerful ancien vampire. But he has to, because he can save Aaron.
The one other element to this as well, which we sort of glanced over, but I just want to bring back, is that in those early chapters as well, when we're on that ticking clock, we get this great moments of who's already under the power. It gives this sign of who can we trust. Invasion of the body snatchers, the first thing that comes to my mind. We were just like, everyone looks normal, but who is under their thrall? So that was a lovely... And it's only in like a chapter of this book do we have this sort of dynamic. Well, maybe two or three. And I'm like, well, great little dynamic. And amongst all this other things going on, we get this little like, who do we trust? Invasion of the body snatchers, couple of chapters. And then we get on to the rest of the narrative and the rest of the stakes. It's really, just to step back to the wider picture again, Geordie, this book really has a great sense of having these small narratives or these small beats that worked sort of in and on their own, yet flowed into the wider adventure.
All right, go ahead. Can you give me an example?
I was thinking, so it's like when we have the sections with, at the very beginning, before they even get separated, like the chapters when it's like they've got the group of kids that they rescue from the town and Lachan? Gabriel's old Lachan. Lachan.
Lachlan.
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 Oh, yeah, obviously.
He's Scottish, Lachlan. Remember?
Gabriel's old apprentice. Like, it's really set up that this is the group.
What an Ahsoka Ahsoka Tano moment. Oh yeah, The Apprentice, you never mentioned before.
That is very true. I actually, because I hadn't read the first one in so long, I was prepared to accept that I'd just forgotten this character. I was like, oh, was he only in it?
No, that's bullshit. I like him. I think he's a serviceable character. Even if his haircut is ridiculous in a medieval setting, like he has like the classic buzzed up sides. He looks like a footballer.
Right, we'll get to the artwork in a sec. But in this moment, I'm like, oh, this is the party. You know, these are the dynamics. This is what playing up. And like, it's this ticking timer where Luckland doesn't know that Gabriel's betrayed the order. So you go for this whole like tense moment. Oh God, when's the reveal going to be? When is he going to find out? When are they going to fight? When's Master and Apprentice going to face off? Like Revenge of the Sith. Like, this is the moment. And then it, you sort of happens, then you move on and you realise, oh yeah, this isn't a book. This isn't Revenge of the Sith. That's not the story. And then you move on to the, like, the next bit of the quest.
I was really surprised the way in which this book played my expectations, because obviously you think, well, now the Silver Order is going to be hunting Gabriel. But actually, and they are. But then by the end of the book, they all team up together because they are fighting a greater evil and they can see past it. And it was really surprising to see that that did happen. I thought that it was going to be about blind zealotry tearing them apart. But no, by the end of the story, they are all still brothers in arms.
So, Luckland. Okay, he was a... Luckland. I pronounced in Lachan for this entire book.
I did as well. I looked it up right before the episode started.
Excellent. Glad it's not me. Just me. Sorry. Yeah, I thought he was a really fun addition. I like the fact that he was used as to give an insight back into Gabriel's world before he left the Order. Mm-hmm. And as we mentioned earlier, maybe I did want a bit more of that. Like, a bit more of these heroic campaigns and holding back the vampiric horde a bit more.
That's why we need Empire of the Vampire of the RPG, because that's the shit I would love to like explore. Just like, you want to make a vampire hunter and go out and fight an army of vampires. Isn't that fucking cool?
It does. And I don't know,
Luckland's got 5 guns strapped to his chest and he just draws them out one by one. Bang, 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 bang.
I'll be honest with you, I'll tell you now, if J. Kristoff finishes off this trilogy and then wants to give me some more content, like filling in the gaps, I would read it. I don't think necessarily it needs to be told in the Absolutely. Third book. I see where he's moving to his end game, but I would happily go and read maybe a shorter story that just kind of fills in Gabriel's time, like completely. I would love that.
Absolutely. Just give me Weird of the Black Lion.
Yeah, sure. Short story collection. There you go, J. Kristoff. You're welcome. We have all the great ideas. So I enjoyed his character. I like the fact the Order was still hunting him and we still had that moment. It's like, you see him look to Gabriel in this different light. I really like the idea that after he leaves the Order, they basically try and make him into this great hero that he wasn't. They're like, you want to sign up, kids? You'll be like Gabriel. Be like the Black Lion. Fight the vampiric horde. And I really like the fact...
Gabriel de Leon wants you.
And I really like the fact that then we get Luckland's perspective on Gabriel and his wife. What a brilliant way to kind of do it. How he's like, oh yes, that wicked Jezebel that turned you away from the true light. Yeah, how does this man reconcile this image that's being sold to him with the fact that Gabriel was kicked out of the Order? It's like, oh yeah, he would just try and demonize Gabriel's wife, Astrid, and say, oh, it was all her fault. He was pure. She was the one at fault.
Yeah, but actually, I agree. That was a really astute bit of writing right there. So, Lachlan and the rest of the Order Argent show up at the end. They join in this huge battle between vampires and humans and dusk dancers and pale bloods. There's a bunch of different showdowns. Literally, Gabriel and the rest of his cohort take a break in the middle of the main battle to fight, like, a bonus boss. They leave, like, a section to be like, alright, hang on. The terrorists have arrived. Let's fight and kill them. And let's just take a little chapter out to fight them, and then we'll get back into the fight. But, without focusing too much on that, even though I really like a lot of the showdowns that happen, and I like... The way in which Dior's blood, it's so intelligently used. Even the wolf is like fixed of mind control and joins as an ally. And I could not have seen that coming. I couldn't. Of course, the wolf was thralled as well. And it turns out he's like a guy, but whatever. But the ending. The ending. When Dior stabs the main vampire through the Lilith through the heart, and she and Gabriel are finally reunited. Duncan, how did you feel about the emotions in this last scene?
So that moment of catharsis, when Gabriel and Dior like have their hug, and we said so at the start of this episode, and she looks at him and she's like, "Papa," and they're holding each other. And you're like, "Oh, this is what it was all about." And you can just—it's this sort of sense of like that scene in the film where they meet on the battlefield and they embrace, and like all the fighting sort of fades around them, and they just have that like you can finally let your breath out and just go, "Okay." And then you remember this whole point of this blooming book is setting up the fact that Gabriel fucks up and loses Dior. And you've got like, oh God, please tell me that's in the next book. Please let this book end on this happy note.
And absolutely, because throughout this book, I'm now thinking to myself, Dior is not lost. Dior is out there and she's actually fighting to free Gabriel, like in the present day. I don't think he does lose her. But I am proved wrong in this scene. This whole scene, it is cathartic, but the whole time I am clenching my book with white knuckles because I think something's going to go wrong. And I was right, because everything goes horribly wrong. But I was wrong in the reason why, because I assumed they're in the Asani's tomb at that point. And I assumed Viasani was going to come out and was so desperate for blood that she was going to go on a little rampage. But I was wrong. A great bit of setup and payoff. Lilith is constantly called the Heartless. Turns out, much like, what was it, A Court of Thorns and Roses, that is literal. She has no heart. So getting stabbed through the heart doesn't do shit to her. And she kills Dior. Dior dies.
No, not just that Dior dies. Dior dies because Gabriel didn't read Berserk. He forgot what was important was protecting the loved ones rather than going for revenge. There's the big reveal is that the first vampires were created by the Jesus figure of this world. It was the curse he laid upon those that broke him on the wheel. You will walk with this world forever. And Gabriel is so upset that his concept of the world is so broken, and he looks to his sister and he realizes, you knew all along and kept this from me. Not that I think there was ever a convenient point that she should really have ever told anyone. Like, how do you bring that up? How is it just around the campfire? You're just meant to go, oh, by the way, Gabriel, I found out the other day, the savior, he's actually the one who damned us all to hell. But beside that,
what do you mean? What do you mean Jesus invented cancer? What? No!
Gabriel, in a fit of rage, abandons Dior, flies across the room to, like, strangle his sister, and doesn't realise that Lilith isn't fully dead. And before he can realise what's happening, Dior lets out one last cry as Lilith snaps her neck. And it is so quick. It's just guttural. This sense of, like, in my stomach of, like, oh God, that's how it happens. And I knew it had to happen. And what makes it so much worse is that I wasn't just upset for, like, Gabriel. It wasn't like, oh no, Gabriel's lost Dior. I was upset that I'd lost the character of Dior, a character that we'd followed for so much of this book, who I was really liking and liked their attitude and had seen so much of the world from, not quite from their perspective, but all their plans and their schemes, and they were a thinker. They'd gone on this huge character arc, and all of that's just wiped away.
That's tragedy, is losing character like that. Yeah, it's true.
It is.
Did you believe she was gone, though?
Sorry?
Did you believe she was gone, though?
Dior? Yeah. Fully. I fully was like, yeah, Dior's gone.
I didn't. See, at this point in the story, both of the siblings are in the same room together, which means they can confer on their narrative. And I just assumed that this was a lie. This didn't happen. My assumption at the moment was like, oh, that's sad. Good thing it didn't happen. They're lying to Jean-Francois. She's not dead.
And do you have any evidence for this?
No, I was completely wrong. She is dead.
She is dead. She is far as we can tell from this book, her character's story ends here. And I'll be honest, Geordie, it actually took me back to Game of Thrones. I genuinely think this is a moment. Despite all the setup about losing the Grail, I kind of was like you. I didn't believe it was going to happen. But it felt like that Ned Stark, because it's not just losing a character that's important to our character, or character that appears to be important to the narrative as a whole. It's about losing a character that the writer has put so much time and effort developing, and that going in the bin. That's what I think really creates that shock that you get when you read something like Game of Thrones and like Ned Stark dies.
I talked last time about how J. Christoph, what he really does well is he turns you, the reader, into a believer. You want to believe in Gabriel and his power to redeem himself. You want to believe in Dior and that the world can be saved. And in this moment, you are, in the same way as other characters, you are inspired by the martyrdom of the new saint, Saint Dior. And so, even in this moment of bleakness, when Gabriel is crushed, he's gone off to have his revenge against the Forever King once again, you still believe. And you're not the only one. Because as the epilogue begins, as Gabriel is left in a room with Dario, this manservant who Jean-Francois keeps forgetting the name of, but who Gabriel does remember the name of and keeps saying, God's sakes, man, his name is Dario, stop forgetting. Dario is left to be like his prey. Gabriel's so hungry for blood now. And then, this was good. This was a really good bit of information reveal. Because even though it went in the direction I was expecting, this particular twist, this I did not see coming. Because it turns out Dario is actually a character who's been in this story the whole time. Like, he has been here, an ally, a true believer in Dior, and the conspiracy is not done. Like, their fight is still going on, they haven't lost, they haven't given up, and you are vindicated for still believing. And that is not the only piece of information which has left until the last minute. Duncan, what is the final twist in the story?
The Grail is finally revealed. Celine tells us that after the funeral of Dior, she's back down in that tomb. The floor is wet with the blood of all those that died there. The blood of Dior mixed in with them all. And that blood seeps into the ground and seeps into the coffin that lies below it. And we get revealed that rising from the earth. Now, Geordie, tell me if I get this right, because I was a little bit like, have I fully understood this? It is revealed that the true Grail, the first of the bloodline from the Saviour, I assumed the Jesus figures, like their own daughter, is a vampire and was sealed in this tomb. And finally, with the blood of the fight, they have enough strength to break free and come back into the world.
Duncan, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
No, I don't completely misunderstand that. I don't look at the end of the book.
Duncan, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
What happens at the end of this book?
So, they've been looking for the Asani Marin, right?
Yeah.
So, Mother Marin, one of the oldest living vampires, one of the oldest existing vampires, one of the people who sacrificed the Redeemer on the wheel. So, she's one of the first people who was cursed with vampirism, along with the Forever King. She is described as little more than a child, and she has been woken up. You know, she's been released from her prison, and she's hungry. But then, stepping forth from her tomb, revived from the dead, comes Dior, San Dior, who has been turned in death into a vampire.
Is that what happened? A girl.
I'm gonna read the last.
The child
page.
She was. A girl, barely more than a babe in stature, skin pale as alabaster, and teeth sharp as truth, and eyes empty as forever. She crashed upon us with all the fear of heaven, all the hateful hunger of hell, starved by a century slumber. Then that person gets called Mother Marin.
And then she stopped, stilled, that gaping maw, dripping red, little eyes deep as the abyss, running upwards now, upwards towards the tomb far above our heads. Inside the crypt they had buried her in, upon the slab they set her on, the Grail lay in repose, still clad in her suit of plate and chain, ashen hair arrayed in a halo around her head, the Red Hand of God they'd named her, Les Demoiselles de Graal. But more and most, a whisper had become a cry, that had become a hymn, it was a simple one and true. San Dior, Marion breathed. San Dior. She was a beauty, motionless in the dark, after a life spent in struggle. Savior, sinner, saint. A girl I cared for. And there in the dark, that girl opened her eyes.
Ah. Yeah, I didn't get that the first time through. And that explains the last picture.
You were in a bit of a hurry when you finished that book, Duncan.
I finished it this morning. What are you on about?
Okay, there we go. I finished just a couple of weeks ago.
And that explains why the last piece of artwork is Dior lying there with her eyes open. Oh yeah, my gosh. Sure, Geordie, I came to this podcast thinking Dior was actually still properly dead forever.
Oh my god! That's very funny, Duncan. I wish I hadn't told you that. I wish you had waited 2 years for the next book and then be like, what the fuck? What did you tell me?
I think it's because Mother Marion was described as childlike and a girl. Yes. So when a girl opens her eyes, I thought it was just Mother Marion opening her eyes again and being called the Grail for some reason. I was very confused.
So you thought that Mother Marion was the Grail?
Yes, and it was some sort of reveal that, like, it was the Saviour's, first of the Saviour's bloodline was one of the vampires, and Dior came from, like, a line started with vampires and, like, silver saints.
No, but it is clear that, like, you know, we kind of brush over it because we want to talk about the death of Dior. Vampires are, like, descendants from the Redeemer? Maybe God? Like, we don't know for sure what the Redeemer is. Like, maybe the Redeemer was actually, like, a demon. And, like, they drank of his blood and it changed them. Like, he was the first vampire. But, like, what was his powers? Like, was he a mortal man who had special blood? And drinking that blood turns you into a vampire? We don't know. Maybe we'll find out in the future books. But I reckon that whatever Dior is, she's going to be, like, a special, different vampire.
Oh, absolutely. Like, this is about her power, and the like I say this, I'm having to create theories now on the fly. So she is still out there. It's not broken. It is all a lie. There is a conspiracy. Hope is not lost. What a great turnaround for the end of the book.
Still not sure how she could end Day's death, though. I genuinely think that the solution to Day's death might be just wait. Like, if humanity just waits, it will get better. Like, it's just an ash cloud. It's just like an Icelandic volcano erupted and the planes have to stop for a little bit. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just like, oh, enough time ran out. God isn't real. Fuck you.
It would be nice to see where that goes. Oh, Jody, there's so much I really enjoyed in this book. Can I just point out... And this,
there's a reason why you've spoken about it for so long.
There's just a few little details. You talked about... that before coming into this, you'd been reading Beowulf Elric. There's Stormbringer in this book. Someone called Stormbringer. Ashdrinker. And I can't help it say that must be a nod.
Or Ashdrinker.
No, there's Stormbringer. It's one of the chapter headings.
Oh, yes, a woman is called Stormbringer. And absolutely, yes, absolutely, it's a definite nod to that. Like, Ashdrinker is inspired by Stormbringer. He's called the Black Lion, Elric is called the White Wolf. Although, to be honest, I'm pretty sure that's more inspired by Geralt, who just ripped that off from Elric, but don't worry about it. But yes, absolutely. And in the lead-up to the final battle, when he looks at Phoebe, he says, like, in her, I see Stormbringer. And, oh, such a fucking badass line. This book's so badass!
Can I really just want to do the one line, which I think is just in... brings it all together. And
Shoot, go ahead.
And let's just do the final quote, the bit where Gabriel just puts it in and you're like, yes, mate, that is the tone we're setting, where he is surrounded by the Dust Dancers and they're like, who are you? What are you doing here? And he simply goes, Gabriel de Leon is my name, mademoiselle. I'm quite sure it precedes me. What a smug bastard. I love this character.
He is a smug bastard. I like him too. I like him a lot more in this book when he's like fighting for something he believes in. And I'm really excited to see where his story goes next time. But we're going to have to wait for that. This took about 2 years to come out. Who knows how long we have to wait for the next one. J. Christoph has like other books to write. I'm pretty sure he also has like a sci-fi YA series.
I hope he appreciates what the priority should always be.
That's right. Yeah, get lost, sci-fi. I want to see the vampires. Actually, one more thing. I think the art in this book, I think it's a lot better than the previous one. I think it's a lot better.
I would say this for the artwork, and I'm glad you brought it back up, because I was almost a bit sad we might have missed talking about it. The art of the first one, at some points I genuinely felt was distracting. And I'm like, that just doesn't quite measure up to my picture. It's not adding anything. In this book, I felt it was either neutral or added a bit. That last picture of Dior, like, lying on her deathbed at the very end of the book, I was like, what a lovely note to end on.
Yeah, and there's, like, I think there's just more of it as well. Like, it appears more frequently. Maybe that's what happens when, like, your first book is really successful. You can be like, I want to pay for more ink to go into my book, please. But, like, there's just one, which is just Gabriel holding his sword towards the viewer. His, like, aegis all ablaze. And it just looks fucking cool. It just looks really badass. It doesn't need to be there. It's just like, yeah, sure. There's also another one of Gabriel squaring down against a big lion-headed Dusk Dancer. And you just see his full butt right there on the page.
Fantastic. Like I said, it was one of my favourite scenes, is that fight. And Jordy, this is one of those stories where I love this book, and should never take away how much I enjoy this book, and this isn't necessarily a mark of quality.
Bro, I was wrapping the episode up, but go ahead.
All I'm saying is, this is a story that I really would love to see translated to other mediums.
Oh yeah, we should this should be the next Castlevania.
Completely. Like, I want a voice actor taking on Gabriel and delivering his kind of one-liners.
No question here, man. This would be fucking slap. It could be an animated series. It could be a video game. It could be a role-playing game. I just want more.
So, Jordy, I take it, do you recommend this book?
I cannot insist enough how much I recommend this book. Read the first book. I know that some people don't like it and they bounce off. If you didn't like the first book, fine, I understand. It is juvenile in places. But if you really see the sincerity behind this book, the sincerity is why it works, and I would seriously recommend this one.
I mean, I'm in the exact same boat. Like, I know there were some nitpicks and there were some bits I've done a bit differently, but ultimately, Empire of the Damned is a better book than Empire of the Vampire. So anyone who read that and enjoyed it even a little, guess what? It gets better. I think it does so much more to forge its own path, even abandoning that kind of special school narrative that's in the first book, which I really liked. Like, by kind of putting that aside, it's like, no, I don't need to rely on tropes as much, except the ones that are really cool and lend to my weird tone of sincerity, brutality, and just silliness.
It is silly in places, but it's a fun kind of silly. Okay, Duncan, we're going to have to wait for the next one. We can't pick it as our next book, as much as I would like to, but it is my choice as to what to read next. And I have to pick this now because it's current. It's in the zeitgeist. I feel like we have to talk about it. When the episode comes out, it will be too long after that inciting moment. We can't quite jump on the bandwagon completely, but we've got to talk about it. It is written lore. The line between science fiction and fantasy is if you go far enough back and you get to just regular Earth, that's sci-fi. But if you go far enough back and there are still wizards there, that's fantasy. And we know that mythology counts as fantasy because we have Song of Achilles and Silence of the Girls. And therefore, Duncan, I think you know where I'm going this, right?
You can't be serious.
It's settled lore. We agreed on this. You can fight me now and you can make me choose something else, but you're going to have to spend a destiny point.
I'm not going to fight you, but I cannot believe you're going to pick this book.
Yes.
Go ahead, announce it.
All right, Silence of the Girls, A very important character in that is the character of Agamemnon. Did you know that that important fantasy character has a great, 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 great grandson whose name is Paul Atreides? He was canonically the direct descendant of Agamemnon.
He is indeed.
It's time, people. We had one charismatic leader rising up to a position of power, but, you know, struggling to keep her morality in place the whole time. It's time for us to jump in on another character who does the same thing but fails utterly to remain a good person. It's time to talk about Dune.
Frank Herbert's Dune. It's been 10 years since I last read this book. Can't wait to read it again.
I'm really looking forward to this. I've been dabbling with it ever since the movie came out, jumping back in, reading some of my favorite chapters. Man, an amazing writer. I'm really excited to properly analyze this. This could be like a fucking two-parter, because there's so much to cover.
We wouldn't be the first ones to split this in half. Alright, Geordie, I'm excited for this. If you're hearing this and you want to give us your opinions on Dune, because I'm sure plenty of people have them these days, please go over to our Instagram.
I know for a fact they do.
And let us know what you think. If you've read Empire of the Vampire or Empire of the Damned or any other of J. Christoph's works, Nevernight is sitting there. It's looking at me. I will read it eventually. Let us know what you think. Best place is our Instagram. It's Just Fantasy Podcast. Follow us there to get all the news and updates. You can also reach out to us on our email. ThisIsJustFantasyPodcast@gmail.com.
I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol.
Au revoir.
Bye.